recent visit to the Mideast, I happened to meet a young couple from a small religious sect found in many Arab countries. While many Arabs would consider them Muslims, my new friends told me they weren't Muslim at all. But the misunderstanding was fine by them if they could get on with their lives as they were used to doing. They belong to a secretive sect which has for centuries remained an enigma to outsiders, its creed and codes of conduct guardedly passed down from generation to generation only in the age of adulthood. When I asked the young man to elaborate a little on his religious beliefs, he winked and, grinning, he said, "We lie about our faith all the time." "What do you mean?" I wondered, astounded by his frankness. "You Catholics and Christians over the years have been so ready and willing to become martyrs for your faith," he said. "We, on the other hand," he explained, "have been taught to lie about our faith in times of persecution. Why be killed for your religion if you can live by simply saying you belong to another faith while you cross your fingers behind your back?" "What would have happened to our religion," he reasoned, "if over the centuries we'd admitted we practiced it, and we were then killed because we refused to convert?" I suppose one could argue he had a point, choosing the lesser of two evils, telling a fib versus the possible extinction of an entire faith. Perhaps he was lying to me, even as he said this. But his comments made me think of all those early Christians martyred for their belief that Jesus Christ was Lord. Were they upholding an undeniable truth? Were they fools? Had they died in vain? From a handful, those first Christians now number billions. Well, at a time when it seems fewer and fewer Christians would be willing to put their lives on the line to defend their faith, I wonder what has happened to our defense of principle, human dignity, and the vindication of truth. Surely, these must be part of the equation. In the following program, Jill Bevilacqua tells us the story of one man, now a saint, who thoroughly believed in the principles of his faith. A man who refused a lie that would have saved, literally, his head. Does he stand as a model for Christian witness today? I'll let you decide.
It is sometimes said that those who become martyrs receive a warning from God beforehand.
Of Thomas More, beheaded on Tower Hill in London in 1535, a story is recounted in the journal of his daughter, Margaret Roper, which suggests that he too had a presentiment of his tragic destiny. He was lying on the hay, with his head on Margaret's lap. His eyes were shut.
"Father, are you asleep?"
"Yes, and dreaming."
"What are you dreaming of?"
"Of a far-off future day, Meg, when you and I will look back on this hour and this hayfield and my head in your lap."
Perhaps More thought he would become a martyr, but he certainly never sought martyrdom. He relinquished life most unwillingly, for he enjoyed it and asked no more than to be allowed to live in peace with his beloved family and many friends. This was not to be, and as More was a man of conscience, a man of integrity, and above all a man of prayer, he had no hesitation when forced to choose between God and man. He chose God.
Thomas More was born in Cheapside, London, in 1478. At the age of 12, he became a page in the household of Cardinal Morton, the King's Chancellor, who recognized the boy's qualities and predicted a great future for him, though he could hardly have guessed that More, too, would become Chancellor one day. After reading Greek at Oxford, Thomas was sent by his lawyer father to study law at Lincoln's Inn, and at 19, he was called to the bar.
Thomas became a brilliant lawyer, but he was also a scholar and the friend of scholars, and he entertained at his Chelsea home the greatest minds of Europe. He held advanced views on the education of women and inspired all his children, especially Meg, with his love of learning. A popular orator, a witty and merry person, his company was sought even by the king, Henry VIII, who made More his chancellor when Wolsey fell from power in 1529.
But More was an astute judge of men and had no illusions of where he stood with the king. He spoke of this to his son-in-law, William Roper.
I believe he doth as singularly favour me as any subject within his realm. Howbeit, son Roper, I may tell thee I have no cause to be proud thereof. For if my head could win him a castle in France, it should not fail to go.
More was not far from the truth, though it was not for a castle in France that he lost his head. In 1532, when Henry wanted to divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn, More could not but oppose him. Moreover, Henry and his followers were passing bill after bill, abolishing papal rights and privileges, and confiscating church revenues. More resigned his chancellorship.
From that moment on, Thomas More was persecuted. He was essentially a public man, in words and actions, but in this, the greatest issue of his life, he was forced into silence and inactivity. Reduced to poverty, he hoped that by keeping silent, he would be left alone. But the confrontation came in 1534, when the Act of Succession was passed. In the preamble of the Act, the Pope's jurisdiction was repudiated. It was the point of no return. And More, together with Bishop John Fisher, refused to sign. He was committed to the Tower.
More had tried to prepare his family for his arrest by having someone knock on the door and call for him on several occasions. When the summons finally came, he allowed none but his son-in-law, Roper, to go with him. And to him he turned, saying, "Son Roper, I thank our Lord, the field is won." At the time, Roper did not understand More's meaning, that he had won his conflict with himself. No one, not even his family, could persuade him to change his mind. Friends of his who were members of the council did their best to shake his resolution in the hope of saving him. His wife and daughters were allowed to visit him for the same reason. Margaret, although she sympathized deeply with her father's position, did her utmost to get him to speak the formula which would set him free.
"You want me to swear to the Act of Succession?"
"God more regards the thoughts of the heart than the words of the mouth. Or so you've always told me."
"Yes."
"Then say the words of the oath, and in your heart think otherwise."
"What is an oath, then, but words we say to God?"
"That's very neat."
"Do you mean it isn't true?"
"No, it's true."
"Then it's a poor argument to call it neat, Meg. When a man takes an oath, Meg, he's holding his own self in his own hands, like water. And if he opens his fingers, then he needn't hope to find himself again. Some men aren't capable of this, but I'd be loath to think your father one of them."
"So should I."
"Then..."
"There's something else I've been thinking."
"Oh, Meg."
"In any state that was half good, you would be raised up high, not here, for what you've done already."
"All right."
"It's not your fault the state's three quarters bad."
"No."
"Then if you elect to suffer for it, you elect yourself a hero."
"That's very neat. But look now, if we lived in a state where virtue was profitable, common sense would make us good, and greed would make us saintly. And we'd live like animals or angels in the happy land that needs no heroes. But since, in fact, we see that avarice, anger, envy, pride, sloth, lust, and stupidity commonly profit far beyond humility, chastity, fortitude, justice, and thought, and have to choose to be human at all, why then perhaps we must stand fast a little, even at the risk of being heroes."
"But in reason, haven't you done as much as God can reasonably want?"
"Well... finally, it isn't a matter of reason. Finally, it's a matter of love."
More did not believe himself worthy of martyrdom, nor was he at all sure that he would be equal to it, should he be brought to the test.
Robert Bolt, who wrote A Man for All Seasons, from which this scene is taken, made this comment on More's stand.
"He knew what area of himself he could yield to the encroachments of his enemies, and what to the encroachments of those he loved. but at length he was asked to retreat from that final area where he located his self. And there this supple, humorous, unassuming and sophisticated person set like metal and could no more be budged than a cliff.
Thomas More did not condemn the many others who signed the act, nor encourage any to follow his example. All he would say of the oath was, "This I am sure, that of those that have sworn it, some of the best learned, before the oath was required, plainly affirmed the contrary of such things as they have now sworn."
To Margaret he confessed his fear of pain, telling her that he was almost afraid of a fillip, and that his flesh was by nature much more shrinking from pain and death than he thought it the part of a faithful Christian man. Knowing that he might be put to the rack, More took the precaution of writing to a friend that if it should be heard that he had taken the oath, people would realise that he had done so only in weakness, and not because he had changed his views. Over 400 years later, Cardinal Mincenti, in the same situation, did exactly the same thing.
More was in the Tower for 15 months, during which time he maintained his silence, despite constant efforts on the part of the King's men to extract a treasonable statement from him. It was Richard Rich, a former member of More's household and now Solicitor General, who finally provided the pretext for bringing More to trial. Rich, who was a notorious time server, falsely reported a conversation he had had with More in the Tower.
Rich asked More if he would take him as king, if Parliament so decreed, to which More replied yes, since that was good constitutional law. Then Rich asked, "But if there were an act of Parliament that the realm should take me for Pope, would you not then, Master More, take me for Pope?" To this, More offered a question of his own. "Suppose the Parliament should make a law that God should not be God, would you then, Master Rich, say that God were not God?"
And at this point, Rich reported More had added, "No more could the Parliament make the King supreme head of the Church." More never spoke these words, but Rich testified against him in the witness box, and on the perjurer's false testimony, More was convicted of high treason. Before sentence was passed, More was allowed to speak. He knew now that there was no redress, and broke his silence at last.
"To avoid this, I have taken every path my winding wits would find. Now that the court has determined to condemn me, God knows how, I will discharge my mind concerning my indictment and the king's title. The indictment is grounded in an act of Parliament which is directly repugnant to the law of God. The King in Parliament cannot bestow the supremacy of the Church because it is a spiritual supremacy. And more to this, the immunity of the Church is promised both in Magna Carta and the King's own coronation oath. I am the King's true subject, and pray for him and all the realm. I do none harm. I say none harm, I think none harm. And if this be not enough to keep a man alive, in good faith I long not to live. I have, since I came into prison, been several times in such a case that I thought to die within the hour. And I thank our Lord I was never sorry for it, but rather sorry when it passed. And therefore my poor body is at the King's pleasure. Would God my death might do him some good."
On July 5th, More wrote to Margaret, sending her the hair shirt he had worn for 40 years and telling her he was to die the following day. The king, fearing More's eloquence, had sent word that he was to speak no more than a few words from the scaffold. So More told the crowds that when he first accepted office, the king himself had given him the most virtuous lesson that ever prince taught his servant, willing him first to look unto God, and after God, to him. This, More claimed, he had done, concluding, "I die the king's good servant, but God's first."
More's last words were in perfect keeping with his whole life and character. he jested with the lieutenant of the tower, charged the executioner to strike straight, and pulled aside the beard he had grown in prison, saying jokingly that it had committed no treason.
Thomas More was beheaded on July the 6th, 1535, a few days after Bishop Fisher. According to custom, his head was impaled on a pike on London Bridge. But Margaret bribed someone to give it to her, and she preserved it all her life. It is buried with her in the Roper Vault in St. Dunstan's Church in Canterbury. His body was first buried in the Tower Chapel, and was probably transferred later to the tomb he had prepared in the church at Chelsea. During the London Blitz in the Second World War, the church was destroyed, but one thing was left intact, the tomb of Sir Thomas More.
Thomas More was a man who enjoyed living. As his friend Erasmus wrote, "There is nothing that occurs in human life from which he does not seek to extract some pleasure, although the matter may seem serious in itself." But when More was put to the test, he found something in himself without which life was valueless. His own act of self-validation turned out to be a martyrdom that he did his best to avoid, but that he had to accept if he was to see any coherence between the course of his life and its end. His death was not the headlong rush of a fanatical zealot into oblivion. It was the fearful, considered decision of a man of great self-knowledge, doing what he had to do, and wishing, almost until the end, that he did not have to do it.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that program drawn from her series Witness on what it is that makes a martyr. Sir Thomas More was beatified in 1886 and canonized by Pope Pius XI in 1935.